Okay, so welcome everybody. This is Terry DeMayo. I am here with Renee Sievert, and this call is Coaching, Ethics, and Professional Responsibility. And I'm going to be talking pretty consistently here. I'll open it up to questions a few times as we go through, because we want a real clean line for this, because this is now going to be the new basic recording for all future life coach training classes. I've got this line on lecture mode. That means you are all automatically muted. If you want to unmute yourself to ask a question at any point, star 6 will do that. So just keep that in mind. You don't need to star 6 yourself if you're in a noisy location, though, because I've got everybody automatically star 6'd here. So I'm just going to dive right in with talking about what this class is all about. Martha Beck, Inc. is an educational program. It does not, in and of itself, monitor or regulate coaches. You go through a basic educational program. You learn a set of skills and tools and approaches to human behavior. When you are finished, you have an option to apply for certification. If you should go through the certification review process, which is a mentoring process, there is no exam that you pass or fail. It's simply a mentoring process to ensure that you've gotten the basics and are competent in them. That means you have achieved basic competency in a set of skills and have fulfilled the basic requirements of the course. Going forward, you don't have a license. You don't pay a fee for licensing. You don't pay a fee for your listing on Martha's website. There is no financial arrangement with you between Martha Beck, Inc. and yourself, like many other coaching programs and educational institutions have. Martha is extraordinarily generous in this regard. She gives us, as certified coaches, a listing on her website. She gives us access and use to her materials under a number of circumstances. And, sorry, I'm turning off the sound on my computer because it's dinging at me. They are very generously available to us. As long as we follow written guidelines that are given to us about the use of Martha's name and her materials. The attitude of Martha Beck, Inc. is that you are trusted to fully and capably take care of yourself and your clients safely, comfortably, and joyfully. Much like we trust our coaching clients as being whole and capable of taking care of themselves, and we act as guides in the coach-client relationship. In this ethics class, we are giving you guidelines. MBI cannot force you to do anything. Your choices are totally yours. You will ultimately decide what you will do and what you don't do, similar to the way your clients make their own choices and decisions for themselves. We provide this class to you to keep you and your clients safe and comfortable and joyful, giving you the best knowledge and guidelines that we possibly can so that you can do that. We are here in this world, and we are all engaged in this business of coaching to try to bring more peace and joy and love into the world. And so these principles were developed with that in mind. They were developed with a lot of love and a lot of thought and a lot of care, and they are our best approximation and our best educated guess, if you will, about what will keep you safe and happy. In the end, you will work for yourself or maybe in an employment arrangement with another institution, but in that you will be free to handle your own situations as you best see fit. What you do is ultimately up to you. What we have based this class on is what we think the best, the safest, the most comfortable approaches are. But again, the choices are up to you. Coaching is an unregulated field. There are no laws per se governing it. We look to the field of psychology. We look to the best practices that have been put into effect to provide these guidelines to you. But in the end, they are guidelines, and there are no regulations in place that we can point to and say this is what you must or must not do. Let's talk for a minute about what coaching is and what it isn't. According to Martha, coaching is a relationship where the coach helps the client clear away the obstacles that are blocking them from their best selves. The coach adds nothing. The coach serves in a capacity to subtract that which isn't working. And how we do that is what you've learned in life coach training and what you are learning in life coach training. The ICF, the International Coaches Federation, defines it a little differently. They say that coaching is partnering with clients in a thought-provoking and creative process that inspires them to maximize their personal and professional potential. It's a similar idea. Both of those definitions and both of those ideas are grounded in a few assumptions. One, the client is the best expert in their own life. The next, we assume that our clients are creative, resourceful, and whole. I'm sorry, my pages are out of order here. We are assuming that we've got a healthy, intact person that we are working with, and we're trying to help them through asking questions, identify and discover their own goals, and design strategies for achieving those goals. So when we talk about coaching, we're talking about a person that is already generally well-functioning and wants to reach higher levels of success. We do this by helping them leverage their strengths, develop themselves in particular ways that brings more success and satisfaction into their career or their personal life. It's a very process-oriented approach. We do not need to be experts in a particular field. You can coach a physician or a lawyer, for example, without being trained in lawyering or doctoring, because you're working with the process of how they go about working in the field in which they have expertise. A mentor, on the other hand, is typically an older and wiser colleague with more experience, typically in the same field, who can pass on their knowledge and experience and open doors to somebody and help them maximize opportunities in their field. A mentor gives direct advice, and they typically have direct experience in the particular subject matter that they are mentoring somebody in. Psychotherapy is also different from mentoring and coaching in that it generally deals with emotional or behavioral difficulties and typically past painful situations. There are some exceptions, as in the case of some humanistic or solution-focused psychotherapy practices, but typically psychotherapy involves treating a disorder that is listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM. And the aim of psychotherapy typically is to bring somebody to normal functioning, whereas coaching takes somebody who is functioning normally and attempts to help them function optimally or more optimally. Although there is some crossover there, and therapists will also work in that same area of taking somebody who is functioning well and wants to function at a higher level, closer to their best potential. Now, let's talk about what a profession is, because we speak about coaching as being a profession. A profession is a vocation with specialized educational training, which is what you're doing in the Martha Beck Life Coach Training Program. A professional typically works autonomously. They will typically work with individual fee-paying clients. For example, a physician works in this capacity. Typically, a physician does not work for General Motors or for Apple Computer and sees patients through those corporate entities. They work independently and autonomously, although they could combine into a corporate structure and a group for efficiency purposes. It usually is a freestanding group that is composed only of physicians providing medical services. The skill, the knowledge, and the authority belongs to the professionals themselves. We depart from many of the professions in that, unlike physicians and attorneys and other mental health professionals, we are self-regulated. That means there is no licensing board, there's no regulatory board, there's no test to take from the state that you reside in, there is no requirement that you're even to be certified in order to be a coach. You can call yourself a coach and begin to coach whenever you want. You may live in a locality that requires you to have an occupational license. That is simply a tax on anybody doing business in that particular area. It is not it has nothing to do with your authority or your competency to do whatever it is that you do. Now, what it means to be self-regulated is that there is no state or national board that is watching over your shoulder, setting up rules of conduct, taking complaints from the public if you should violate those rules of conduct, and acts as a body that can take that license away. Now, I believe that we want to keep it this way. It gives us a lot more freedom to be experimental, to be creative. I know that when I practiced law, my license was a very protected thing that I held, and part of what my practice was representing professionals in licensing proceedings where there was a complaint filed against them. And very often those complaints were without merit, yet my clients had to go through a very expensive emotionally and financially process in order to protect their license. And, you know, without getting into a whole lot of philosophy about whether that's good or not, I think it's really great because, again, it allows us to be experimental. Just this last year, the state of Tennessee had a bill before the legislature to license coaches, and in order to have a license as a coach, you had to have a PhD in psychology in order to qualify as a coach. So many mental health professionals wouldn't have even qualified for that. Luckily, that legislation was defeated, and the profession of coaching remains unregulated and unlicensed in that state. There was another attempt in Colorado a few years ago, but you can see right away how restricted that might be. Unless you had a PhD in psychology, under that law, you would not have been able to practice coaching. Now, as Martha Beck coaches, we are guided by the concept of TAO, transparent, authentic, and open. This means that we are honest. It means we're forthright. We do not make exaggerated claims about our experience, our credentials, our associations. We're not doing things like advertising, lose 50 pounds in 3 weeks, or work with me and meet the man of your dreams, or live happily ever after. I've worked with thousands of people just like you, blah, blah, blah. We don't exaggerate those kinds of claims. That would not be transparent, authentic, and open. We're guided in part by our body compass, by our intuition, and I'll talk more about that a little bit, but we want to pay attention to that concept of being transparent, authentic, and open as an ethical guideline when we're making decisions about what we do and don't want to do as Martha Beck coaches. I've got one more introductory part to talk about here, and then we'll get more into the substance of our topic today. But that is the purpose of a body of knowledge like professional ethics. And that, I do believe, is necessary because we have a special obligation to the public. And this is typical of any kind of profession. We hold a kind of a revered status. Doctors, lawyers, accountants, the clergy, psychologists, licensed clinical social workers have a revered status in the community. And because of that, as coaches, there is an imbalance of power. Now, we talk about coaching as being a partnership with our clients. We talk about our clients having autonomy to make decisions for themselves. But, and this is a very big but, your words and your attitudes are going to carry huge weight with your clients. They are going to hang on your every word. And if you're a brand new coach or you're in life coach training, you may have to trust me on this. You may feel like you don't know what you're doing, your knees are knocking together, you're really scared. But I encourage you to recognize that while this may be going on for you, and that is part of your personal work to move through this, your client doesn't see it that way. Your client has come to you to improve some part of their life. You are a witness to their pain and discomfort in a very intimate relationship. They are going to tell you things they have never told anybody in their lives. They will rely on you. They may assume things about you that are not true. For example, that every aspect of your life is in perfect order. That you never have a disruptive kind of conversation or a dysfunctional day in your life. We know that that is not true. We know that clients will want to put us up on pedestals. We know that we don't belong there. But you will nonetheless be intimidating to many of your clients. They will look forward to their appointments with you. For some of your clients, the high point of their week is going to be the hour that they get to spend with you, and you're going to be a powerful presence in their lives. So even if you are uncomfortable as you step into this role and feel enormous responsibility here, do your work, see it in perspective, but also remember you've got tremendous power to influence your clients. And so this class is designed with all of this in mind so that you have some guidance through some of the more troublesome places that typically come up if trouble is going to arise. Now, for most of you, most of the things I'm going to be talking about are never going to arise. But we want you to be prepared and thoughtful in the event that something does come up that requires you to dig a little deeper than you're typically digging. Now, as Martha Beck coaches, we say that we're transparent, authentic, and open. We use our body compass, that is, to use and connect with the signals from our body. We talk about stillness, wordlessness, getting very quiet and listening to our inner voice, tuning in to our essential self and our inner wisdom. And we want to respect what that is telling us as a guideline and a principle when we're talking about professional ethics. We also can rely on just our good judgment and common sense and our personal values, the ones that you came into Life Coach training with, the ones you already have. Now, this does not mean that we confess to our clients our foibles and the places where we are struggling with the same things that they are struggling with. That is not what transparent, authentic, and open means. If we are in a blind spot, the way to handle it is to climb back into your essential self, finish the coaching call, get yourself coached or do some self-coaching through your blind spot, and then decide, is this a client that I can carry on with or not? I know a lot of new coaches and new coaching students believe that transparent, authentic, and open means confessing to a client, oh my God, I don't know what I'm doing here. I can't help you with this. My husband had an affair too, and oh my God, I can understand why that upsets you so much. This is not what transparency is all about. When you step out of that leadership role, imagine being the client and hearing that. You're going to think, oh my God, even this coach can't figure out how to deal with this. This problem is bigger than I even imagined. The right response there is to notice your own upset, to be particularly careful that you might have an agenda, to climb back into your essential self and back in your body, finish the session as authentically as you possibly can, and then make a decision afterwards, after you've gotten some coaching and you've gotten to a place of calm, can I continue with this client or not? And if you discontinue the relationship, you do not have to go into a big explanation why, because you want to protect the client's ability to come through their problems and don't want to give them messages that those kind of problems are insurmountable. So that's a little thing about blind spots that typically comes up for us as Martha Beck coaches because of this issue of transparency and openness. At this point, I'm just going to take a little break. I'm going to see if, Renee, do you have anything to add to what I've been talking about so far, or if anybody has a question about what I've been talking about so far? We'll do that right now.
No, I don't have anything to add, Terry. It was just a really beautiful summary.
Okay. I don't see a hand raised. I don't hear a question. So I'm going to keep going here. Let's start by talking about coaching agreements and informed consent. A coaching agreement or contract, and everybody take out their pens because I'm going to say something really important here that there's a lot of confusion about. It does not have to be in writing. An agreement does not have to be in writing to be a lawful and binding contract. But it's an excellent idea to have one in writing because then there's no mistake about what the agreement is and what it's not. So a good agreement would establish the terms of service. It would provide clarity about what a coach is, what a client is, who does what. It would advise about confidentiality and the exceptions to confidentiality, which we'll talk about in a minute. It would provide for informed consent, which I'm going to talk about in a moment. And I like having an agreement because it gets certain things in writing. I don't have to spend time discussing it with my client, and everybody knows what the ground rules are. But again, it doesn't have to be in writing. You and I could have an agreement. Will you coach me? Yes, I will. We've now got a coaching contract. It requires no more formality than that, although more formality and more detail is highly recommended. Now let's talk about what informed consent is, because that's a concept that might be new to many of you. Informed consent is a legal concept that requires sufficient information for somebody to voluntarily agree. The consent must be voluntary. It must be given by a mentally competent person. A minor, for example, by law is not competent to enter into a contract. They would need their parent or guardian's consent to agree. If you are going to have surgery, informed consent is necessary. Simple consent would be, we're going to remove your appendix. Informed consent says, we're going to remove your appendix. There is no guarantee of success, and the anesthesia might kill you. And if you've ever read an informed consent before surgery form, it's a lot more complex than that, but that's basically what it's saying. It's so that people understand the risk that is being taken and exactly what they're agreeing to. Now, in coaching, we don't have a life or death risk. The risk, in fact, is minimal under ordinary circumstances. People are not at risk of death or serious bodily injury as a result of coaching. And because we're working with people who are functioning normally, there is very little risk of injury. But we do recommend informed consent because there is a lot of confusion about what the difference is between coaching and psychotherapy. And we want to hold ourselves out as coaches and accurately state what we can and cannot do, what we do and do not do. And in that informed consent, we don't overstate our credentials. We don't overstate our abilities. We don't claim we are a certified coach if we are in training or that we have never gotten certified. Informed consent tells the truth. I'm in training. I have completed training, but I am not certified. I am certified in this. We don't claim we can cure people. We don't claim we can fix people. We don't claim even that we can banish unwanted thoughts and limiting beliefs forever, because we can't. We say, I'm a coach. I work with people who are functioning well. I help you help yourself. I don't cure you of anything or fix your problems. You take responsibility for your life. I ask questions. I don't give advice. Does this make sense? And are there any questions about, I'm going to assume it makes sense, and I'll just ask, if anybody has a question, you can hit star 6 and ask it at this point about informed consent or the coaching contract. Okay, I don't hear anybody. Now let's talk about who the client is. Normally, it's very obvious. It's the person who is asking you to enter into the coaching relationship with them. But what happens when somebody else is paying for the coaching? A parent, a relative, or a corporate employer? The person paying for the coaching is not the client, and they are not entitled to special confidential information other than whether the client has attended the session so that the bill can be paid. People will understand this if you tell them up front. Now, I want to be clear about confidentiality. There is no law requiring it. Unlike the regulated professions where there are legal obligations to hold client confidences or patient confidences confidential, there is no law here because, again, remember, we are unregulated and unlicensed. But we do provide and agree to hold client confidences because that is what provides for the trust between you and a client so that progress can be made. And without that trust in you as the coach, you're not going to get very far. So we offer confidentiality, but we cannot guarantee it. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Let's stick with who is the client when somebody else is paying. When you're working with a minor, in general, you don't need a written agreement any more than you need a written agreement with anybody else. But again, it's a really, really good idea just to get a written acknowledgement from the parent that you're going to be working with their minor child and that they agree to it. You discuss confidentiality with the parent and the child early, prior to entering into the coaching relationship. Confidentiality issues don't change because of the age of the client. It's crucial to the success of the coaching relationship whether you're dealing with a child or an adult. But the paying party also, typically if a parent is paying for coaching, they've got some amount of anxiety about what's going on with their child. And good parents are extremely curious about what's going on with their kids. And they may be tempted to ask. So you will put that issue to rest early on if you just gently explain to the parent. And it's best to do this when you've got both of them either on the phone together or in front of you together. I'm going to keep what Susan says confidential because that will protect our relationship. But, Mom, I'm going to let you know that she's showing up and making a good effort. That's all I will tell you. If she wants to tell you more about it, she is free to do that. I'm going to ask you, don't ask her directly, because if she feels any pressure about it, it might interfere with the progress we're making. That being said, most parents will agree to that. When an employer, like a corporation, a corporate employer, is paying, they may require a status report, a progress report. When I do this, it becomes part of the informed consent in my coaching agreement. I will report to your employer that you are making progress towards your goal. And that's all my progress reports ever say. Susan is engaged in coaching and making progress towards the identified goals. I don't say any more. I don't say any less than that. The client needs to know that status reports like that are being given. Otherwise, it would be a breach of client confidentiality. Now, just so you know, if you are coaching corporate clients, some of those clients don't believe anyway that you're going to keep their confidences, and they may not entrust you with the same information. I have a client right now whose employer is providing her with a coach. She tells me, you know, I tell her X, Y, and Z, but I'm going to also tell you some other things. She's just not comfortable in that role. So if you sit in that seat, just understand and have some compassion that the client may not entrust you with everything, but I think ultimately you can gain that confidence by showing up and reassuring the client that you do respect it. And then you just do your best. Any questions about third-party payments before we move on? Or anything you want to add, Renee?
No.
Okay.
You're being very clear. Great.
All right. Let's talk about confidentiality. As I've said before, it's essential to the success of the coaching relationship that we keep the confidences of our client. It establishes an atmosphere of trust. We cannot guarantee it, though. Unlike a physician, where there is a law in place stating that a physician cannot be compelled to reveal the patient-doctor confidences, normally, unless they violate abuse laws, and we'll get into those separately, but the fact that you've got, appendicitis, the doctor cannot be forced to talk about that outside the doctor-patient relationship. Coaches could theoretically be subpoenaed into a court and forced to testify about the nature of the relationship. I am unaware of this happening, but conceivably it could. Now, let's talk about what is confidential. Even the fact that somebody contacted you is part of the confidential relationship. And I think that is true whether or not that person hires you. The fact that they contacted you to talk about coaching is confidential. I think the nature of what is being, the content, clearly, what is being discussed is confidential. Now, can you disguise the identity and the location of the client so that it would never be nobody could ever figure out who that client is, and then talk about it? I think there are circumstances under which that's permissible and circumstances under which I think it's a breach of confidentiality. Let's talk about when it's permissible. In my coaching agreement, it says that I might discuss their case, with my coaching students, because I'm a coaching instructor, the agreement says I will change the identity and the facts sufficient so that that person will never be identified. And I've never had a client have a problem with this. If you are a newer coach, you could have similar language that I might discuss your confidential information with a mentor, never in a way that discloses your identity. I think that's totally, totally permissible. But this is where I don't think it's permissible to talk about client confidences. I've got a client whose husband is going to have a sex change operation. Oh, my God. I'm at a party and I say something like that. Nobody knows who that client is. I've got clients all over the world. It would be impossible to identify that person. That feels really icky to me. And I'm going to bet it feels pretty icky to you. Gossiping about client situations for entertainment purposes, I think, is a breach of confidentiality and a breach of coaching ethics, even if we don't technically break the rule and disclose who the client is or even what city they live in. I think it's just extraordinarily unprofessional to do that. But I don't hesitate to talk about a client situation in a class, or I will talk about a client situation with a coach friend and say, you know, I got this situation going on. How would you handle it? And we might bat it around and talk about it and try to understand the client and come up with a good strategy. No problem there. It is in my agreement because I want the client to be aware that this might happen from time to time. So client confidentiality, another important point is that it belongs to the client. I've had clients say, is it okay if I tell somebody that you're coaching me? I think you're really good, and I would like to post something on my blog or on Facebook, or I'd like to tell my friends about you. Is that okay? Not only is it okay, it's appreciated, is what I tell the client. The right of confidentiality belongs to you, client. And if you, as client, would like to tell somebody about this relationship, I would be most honored. You have no obligation to do so. I would never ask a client to do so. I would never put pressure on them in any regard like that. But if they want, the right belongs to them, and they're totally free to do that. Here's another way it comes up. Would you speak to my therapist about my situation? Yes, absolutely. Give your therapist permission to speak to me, and we will talk together. I've had clients ask their therapist to talk to me. I've had clients ask me to talk to their therapist. I have asked to speak to a therapist as well when I thought it was necessary. I'm not shy about that at all. I've never had a client. It's been rare, but in the few instances I have done that, I've never had a client say no. I've had clients ask, could their spouse come to a coaching session so that I could explain X or Y or Z to them. I'm totally fine with that. I'm comfortable with that. But I would never pressure a client, you know what, you need to get your husband into the next session so we can talk about this together. That's pushing the client into breaching confidentiality. So is this making sense, these distinctions? The client is free to divulge confidential communications. They can tell everybody that goes on in a session anything they want. That's totally up to them. They can ask you to speak to somebody else. You can ask to speak to somebody else if you have a professional reason to do so, and it's in conformity with the coaching agenda, and it's done respectfully, no problem there. Now, there are some exceptions to confidentiality. What we agree to and what we offer is not absolute. As I explained before, a court could order us to speak about a client in either a deposition, or our records could be subpoenaed. We could be required to appear at the Jones divorce trial to provide testimony. You must obey a subpoena and comply with what it asks you to do. You do not have a lawful excuse not to do it. Now, if it were me and I were served with a subpoena, I would get myself a lawyer immediately because I just don't want to do that. I don't want to go there. I don't want to do that. Unless, of course, a client is asking me to do it, then I would gladly and willingly go. But if an opposing party is trying to get me to come in and divulge, I would, in fact, start with an attorney to see if there was some reason that I might not be aware of in that lawsuit where I didn't have to show up and do that. I might not be able to prevent it, but I would give it a shot. Another exception to confidentiality is if the client is a danger to themselves or another in particular ways that I'm going to go through right now. And it's not a bad idea to have this right in your agreement. I will hold your communications with me confidential unless you give me information that suggests you're a danger to yourself or to others, in which case I will breach confidentiality. Let's talk about the client is planning to harm themselves. This is an instance where your immediate action is required. If they are talking about suicide or causing themselves great bodily harm, your immediate action is required. Now, when you've got a suicidal or potentially suicidal client with you, it's important to recognize that they are not in their right mind. They are suffering from a mental illness at that time. They are not thinking clearly. This is not the time for thought work or any other coaching. It is not appropriate. They need to be dealt with immediately by either emergency personnel or somebody trained in suicide risk prevention. Your job as coach, if you suspect suicide at that point, is to determine, and here's another cool thing to write down that's important, you are trying to determine increased risk for suicide. And if you believe that this client is at increased risk, you take action. Because suicide is one of those irreversible things that we can never be certain of. A suicide is fatal. When in doubt, proceed as if there were certainty. And it's better to over-respond than to misjudge and lose a life. Now, I have been in this situation before, and I want to tell you that staying calm is essential, and it might well challenge you. So this is the time to use your tools, to use your breath. A heightened emotional response on your own part might be very likely. So be sure to ground yourself and breathe as you are discussing whatever with a client, but don't delay to take action and self-coach. If you are in the United States, the guidelines give you the phone number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. I am updating, we are in the process of updating these guidelines, and there is an organization that operates in other countries worldwide called befrienders.org, and they have country-specific information and hotlines and lifelines. I'll talk more about the United States because I'm more familiar with it. If a call, anybody in emotional distress or a suicidal crisis is free to call that number. Those calls are routed to a network of crisis centers around the country. There are about 150 crisis centers within the U.S., and they provide counseling and mental health referrals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And what we suggest if you're in the U.S. is that you put this phone number in your contacts or address book so that it is available should you ever need it. It's very likely you won't, but this is such a dangerous situation, and it does happen every now and then, so we want you to be aware of it. The next thing you need to know about is how to determine increased risk for suicide. Sometimes people will just say flat out, I don't see any reason to go on. Or they might even use the word suicide itself. They don't have to use that word, though, to be at increased risk. Other factors pointing to possible increased risk for suicide, increasing use of alcohol or drugs to numb pain, reckless behavior. You know, they tell you they're flying down a freeway at 80 miles an hour in heavy traffic. Anxiety, agitation, disrupted sleep patterns, withdrawn, isolation. They talk about revenge or show a lot of rage, extreme mood swings. All of these are signs and symptoms that somebody might be at increased risk. A past history of a suicide attempt is a huge risk factor for death by suicide. In the event that you suspect somebody is at increased risk, there are certain questions to ask them, and you do it calmly. And what I want you to know is that these questions will not push a person to suicide. They don't give us a possibly suicidal person an idea that had not occurred to them. These questions are the responsible and kind thing to do. You ask, and this is in your written guidelines, are you thinking about killing yourself? Have you ever tried to hurt yourself before? Do you think you might try to hurt yourself today? Have you thought about ways that you might hurt yourself? Do you have pills or weapons or means to kill yourself in your house today? Now, you listen for the answer and you take into account those other risk factors. Somebody might say, no, they're not thinking about killing themselves. They've never tried before, and they don't have any lethal means to kill themselves and still be at increased risk. If they say yes to any of those questions, obviously they're at increased risk. But they still could say no, but the kind of hopelessness, no reason to live, the agitation and anxiety or feeling trapped and hopeless might still be present and still give you reason to suspect that they are at increased risk. So you ask the questions directly, a yes to those, and you take action. A no to those, you still contemplate whether to move forward. Now, if you decide, oh my gosh, you know, there's a possibility here, there's an increased risk, I need to do something, here is what you do. You say to them, I am going to get you some help. Don't leave them alone. If you are on the phone, don't hang up the phone and say, call 911. I'm hoping that you have another line that you could call somebody on. If you don't, then three-way call. Figure out a way that you can do a three-way call. Most cell phones, if that's your only phone, most cell phones have the capacity to do that so that you keep the client on the line. And call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline and get them on the phone as quickly as possible. Get the two of them talking to each other, the client and somebody from the Lifeline. If the Lifeline is not immediately available, and I've heard once in a while I got one report of a delay, or if you don't think the client is going to stick around or the client hangs up, you call 911 and dispatch them immediately. Don't hesitate to do it. If you are in another country, then you need to know what steps to take in that country, and befrienders.org is a good place to start there. They've also got an excellent list of risk factors for suicide. After the crisis is over, you make a referral to a mental health professional, but you do not make that referral instead of getting an emergency person either on the line or dispatching 911. It is not an alternative route. You make that referral after the fact, after the crisis is over, because otherwise it might be too late. So you either get the client talking to somebody trained from the Lifeline, or you dispatch 911. Any question about any of the confidentiality that I've talked about so far, and in particular about the suicide situation? Anything to add there, Renee?
No, Terry, I think you really covered it well. I think just to underscore what you said about asking these questions does not increase the risk at all. In fact, it shows the person that you're really taking it seriously. And
yeah,
it's so important to do that.
Yeah, yeah. And there is a rumor that contracts to tell you, let's say you've got somebody with a history of a suicide attempt, there are some mental health professionals, and then I've heard of coaches having a suicide contract in place. If I start to feel suicidal in the future, I promise to call you first. There is no evidence that those work or they reduce the incidence of suicide, so I would recommend that you don't rely on that.
I totally agree, and it sets up a situation where they feel that, you know, they want to please you or don't want to lie to you or whatever, and it makes them go underground.
Yeah.
So I completely agree with you.
Yeah. Okay. So now let's talk about danger to others. You may, depending on where you are in the United States or where you are in the world, have a duty to report child abuse and or abuse to the elderly. There are categories, there are three factors to consider when we're talking about a duty to report, to break confidentiality, and to report abuse. One is, what is abuse? Does abuse mean I lost my temper and swatted my kid on the butt 5 years ago? you know, versus, you know, I cut a switch out of the backyard and I hit my 4-year-old's legs so hard last night that they drew that it drew blood. Very different situations and circumstances. So number one, and I can't define for you, I wish I could, I can't define for you what abuse is. It varies widely from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Who is required to report? In the state of Florida, there is a pretty broad duty to report. We've got a lot of elderly people here. In some states, abuse to the elderly is not required. So there's the three categories. One, what is abuse? Two, who are the categories of protected people? And three, who are the entities required to report? In some states, you've got to have a license or be a teacher before you're required to report. If you're simply a bystander, a family member, a friend, there's no duty. In other states, anybody is required to report. In some states, elderly are protected. In some states, elderly are not. And then, if you're in California and your client is in Florida, do you use Florida law or do you use California law? Nobody knows the answer to these questions clearly. When in doubt, get some expertise. You know, coach yourself, get to a place of calm. Use your body compass, use your intuition, use your common sense. And you can always contact Renee or myself. You can contact another master coach or a mentor. You can contact a lawyer. But do consider breaking confidentiality if you learn that somebody else is being harmed or abused. Any question about that? And there is a distinction between abuse that happened in the past. There is a clear duty to report that. However, is there a duty, does a duty arise if you learn that a client is planning abuse in the future? In that case, I would definitely recommend that you seek legal help immediately. If the client says, I'm going to kill my husband, and you know they're not making a joke, that this sounds serious, get yourself some legal advice right away. I'm not going to go into it. It's a developing area of the law. It's complex. I've never heard of it happening. Theoretically, it could. So that's a situation to get yourself some legal advice. If you've heard about abuse that's already happened, see if you're in a covered if you're a covered person, is it abuse? And is it a category of person that requires reporting and take action from there? If you don't know, get somebody to help you decide. In these kind of situations, you may, in addition to needing to break confidentiality and report, you may want to consider terminating the coaching relationship. You may want to consider that this is just not a coaching candidate. You want to do it in a way that doesn't exaggerate or cause further harm to the person or cause them further distress. But I think it's always important that we consider, I love the way Bridget says, you know, we've always got to consider our pay grade. Somebody like Renee, who is also a mental health professional, can handle things that you or I might not be able to handle. This is respecting and honoring our pay grade. And I don't know about you, but I got into this because I wanted more fun and less stress in my life. If you do too, stay within your pay grade, like Bridget says. So in the event that something like this comes up, you may want to terminate the relationship. You may want to refer somebody to a mental health professional and be willing to continue to coach them if their doctor or a mental health professional says it's okay. And I had this happen once, actually, a client. I gave her some typical coaching homework, and she reported a lot of anxiety doing it. And I did it one more time, and she responded by saying it made her extremely anxious. And after I talked to her a little bit, I said to her I wanted her to consult either with a mental health professional or with her family doctor and get cleared for coaching, because I did not. Coaching can increase discomfort. It can bring up some anxiety. But when this went on over the course of several weeks and the client was increasingly more and more anxious in such an unpredictable way, I did not feel comfortable going forward with that. I was basically, what tools was I going to offer her if tools were making her feel worse? And this wasn't somebody who came to me anxious already. This is somebody who wanted to have a happier life, and now all of a sudden we're provoking tremendous amounts of anxiety. I would have been happy to continue coaching her had her doctor or a mental health professional cleared her. She said she would do that. I never heard back from her. I don't know what happened, but I feel really good that I ended that relationship. Let's talk about some other places where confidentiality is compromised or breached. Obviously, if you're working with a group or if you're working with couples, if there's more than one person in the room or on the line, you cannot guarantee confidentiality, and I think it's important to make that clear with your groups and with couples. If something is being recorded and you're going to offer it for sale, I think you need to disclose that those sessions will be recorded and distributed to others who aren't on the call. How you go about doing that may depend on the nature of the call itself. You know, if you're having a lighthearted call about how to bring your dreams into reality, you might deal with that one differently than a call that I did a few years ago, a teleclass on how to decide whether, when to stay and when to go, how to decide whether you wanted to break off a relationship or not. People were extremely nervous about that call, and, you know, we told them, make up a name, make up a city. Don't use any identifying information. It doesn't matter. We'll coach you anyway. But we cannot guarantee your privacy, even on this call. And that worked well. People are happy to know that they can do that. Let's talk about thanking referral sources, another possible place where confidentiality can be breached. Joe sends Susan to you. Susan hires you. Can you thank Joe? I think you would be breaching a confidential relationship if you did it that way. If Joe sends Susan to you and you have an initial call with Susan and you say, may I thank Joe? And she says, oh, sure. And then she hires you and you thank Joe right away, I don't think you've breached confidentiality there. But you want to do it in a gentle way. And if you think the client is nervous at all or has any shame going on about needing coaching, and some clients do, leave it alone. Don't thank Joe. Okay, another situation. Joe sends Susan to you. Susan hires you. And then Joe says, hey, I sent somebody to you. Did she ever call? I don't think you can say yes or no there. I would just say, you know, I appreciate that so much. I don't ever discuss whether anybody calls me or not because it's a breach of confidentiality, but thanks so much for giving my name. That's awesome. That way, it remains confidential. The fact that people have called us to inquire about coaching is as confidential as them telling you that they, you know, in the course of a coaching relationship, that they had an affair that their spouse doesn't know about. That's obviously very confidential, but so is the fact that they contacted you in the first place. Any questions about client confidentiality? Okay. Now let's talk about choosing clients wisely, which is one of the best preventative measures that you can possibly take to stay safe and comfortable and joyful in your coaching. Michael Port in Book Yourself Solid refers to having a red velvet rope policy. He says, work with only clients who energize and inspire you. Now, this can be wildly different for different people. Some people love doing square two work. They don't like to get into the square one meltdown kind of stuff. They're not comfortable. It doesn't energize them. I love a good square one client that's stuck in their muck and can't see their way out. For me, that's fun and energizing. If it's not fun and energizing for you, why do it? Your expertise and your experience may also predict who you want to coach. Sometimes people get themselves into some hairy kind of situations and they want some coaching to work their way through it. Sometimes there's something in your own background that is either unresolved or currently up for you that you may not want to deal with. For some clients, doing grief work is beautiful, honorable, lovely, lovely work that they want to do. For others of us, we're not comfortable with it. It's not our sweet spot. You're more likely to get in over your head when you get in over your head from the get-go. You know, clients will, I had a client once in the middle of a coaching relationship about career, got a cancer diagnosis, and I wound up coaching her through chemotherapy. I was comfortable with it, but I can tell you there are times in my life when I might not have been comfortable working with somebody, when somebody close to me was in chemotherapy and dying of cancer. I would not have wanted that client, and I would have referred her out. So you need to ask yourself, is this inspiring? Is this energizing? Am I having fun with this? Have I let go of my old stories about this situation? A client comes to me and says, my husband is having an affair. I don't know what to do. If you are still seething over the affair that your husband had, I'm going to suggest to you that this may not be a fun, inspiring client, and you are going to compromise her ability to work through this and your own ability to work through your own stuff if you take that client on. We want to be clean and clear. You know, Martha talks about the hell and back story, but remember, she's got the back in there. And I think that that's significant. Going to hell and coming back makes you a really good coach to work with that situation if you want to and if it interests you. And remember, just because you've been to hell and come back out of it doesn't mean that you've got to work with those clients or you should work with those clients or you would want to work with those clients. your own body compass and your own inner wisdom is going to help you make these distinctions. You don't have any obligation to take all comers. And there is a particular kind of personality disorder called borderline personality disorder, and it's a mental health diagnosis, and these people are particularly adept at drawing you into their hopeless situation. They have no money. Everything in their life is a mess, typically, and you are the only person that has ever been able to listen to them and help them out. And there were a couple of years when almost every life coach training forum had a situation like that. I think we must be doing a better job teaching, Renee, because I haven't seen that on one of the LCT forums in a couple of years. But they tended to be very expert at drawing the cadet in and then the cadet feeling responsible for continuing that relationship. You have no responsibility, and in fact, when you're feeling that kind of burden or obligation, it's probably a pretty good sign that you need to get out of that relationship. Now, what I do to this day is a free initial consultation with every single person that I'm going to coach. I don't do it with coaching students because I tend to know them, but if it's a muggle from the outside, 100% of the time I will have a free initial consultation. And I use it as a screening tool, and I'm beginning that coaching relationship right away during that. I'm trying to get a sense of the client, who they are, what kind of rapport we can establish, what's the problem, are they willing to listen to me or do they want to talk, do they energize me, am I interested, am I intrigued, am I inspired, is this a puzzle I want to help solve? Otherwise, I've got a really early and easy way to say, you know, I don't think that I'm the right coach for you, but I wish you so much luck and success in your journey. Thank you so much for considering me. Pretty easy to use that session as a screening tool. You do not have to coach the client. You do not have to offer a free coaching session. You're totally free to do that if you want to do it. I just make it a consultation. It takes about a half an hour. And I give the client the opportunity to ask me questions, and I answer those questions. And they get a sense of me, and I get a sense of them. Sometimes clients will also be in mental health treatment. And don't be shy about asking that question. It's not an invasion of privacy to say, are you seeing a therapist presently? Are you working with anyone else about this? I don't ask it all the time because it's not always appropriate, but if I suspect something is going on, I will ask it. I will ask if they're taking any psychoactive medications, if I suspect that, if my body compass is, you know, or my marmoset is going off about that. I want to know what I'm dealing with. You've suffered from depression in the past. How are you feeling now? How are you dealing with it? Is your therapist giving you tools to deal with it? What are you doing? How is it working for you? And you'll get a lot of information by asking some kind, compassionate questions. Some people come to us extremely troubled. They might have a history of job loss. They might have a history of job interviews causing them anxiety where they can't get through. They get like a deer in the headlights. these are the kind of things you want to pay attention to and may come up once you're already in the coaching relationship. Pay attention to this. Don't just keep going blindly. Are you making progress with this client? And you, it's totally legitimate to have a check-in session with a client, and I will do this from time to time. Are you getting anything out of this? Tell me how you're feeling now about your life as compared to how you felt when we started. These are legitimate questions to ask. Listen carefully to the answer and use them for guidance. Referring a client for mental health treatment. Let's talk about how to do that and when to do it. You've got some written guidelines about this. I'm not going to go through them, but what I want you to understand is that we're looking, the guidelines we gave you have to do with behavior rather than these are the signs and symptoms of bipolar disorder, because we're not going to be able to train you to diagnose. But what you need to do is to look for behavior and changes in behavior. Are they making progress? Or, like the anxious client I have, are they deteriorating in a way that's giving concerns? You do it when it feels right, not because, and you don't put it off because you're feeling guilty or responsible or like the only one, or because your mother got caught up in the mental health system and you found that therapists are terrible people. If you've got your own opinions about the mental health system, please coach or self-coach or get yourself coached so that you can be clean and clear about this. There are good and bad therapists out there. There are good and bad coaches out there. The responsibility to refer somebody out goes beyond your own personal experience with the mental health system. Do it as soon as you think the client needs the extra help. And you can do it in a very gentle way. You can refer. I never give names. First of all, I work worldwide, so I don't know therapists everywhere. But here in town, I don't give names either, just because I'm not comfortable doing that. I don't know anybody I'm comfortable referring to. If I did, I would. But you can also tell them to talk to their family doctor and ask for a referral, or their county mental health agency will give them names of people. There are no hard and fast rules about this. You may never have to do it. You may want to refer people to their primary health provider just to rule out medical issues. You know, before we continue with this, I'd like you to get a clearance from your primary care practitioner. Totally fine to do it. When in doubt about any of this, consult an experienced coach. Talk it over with somebody. Get a mentor to help you out. That's totally legit. Any questions about the mental health issues, when to refer, choosing clients wisely, any of these things that we talked about? Or Renee, maybe you've got something to add here.
Well, the only thing I would like to add is just really to encourage everybody to read the guideline that Carrie put together, because it's very comprehensive and it gives you a lot of categories to kind of think about that might be a red flag. And I think the basic thing that helps me, even, you know, with my experience as a licensed mental health person, is to ask about how they're functioning. You know, are they getting up? Are they going to work? Or, you know, are they doing the things they would normally do? And if they're not, you know, aside from being in a square one meltdown, then they aren't functioning normally. And that's, you know, Terry started the call out by saying we're working with healthy, functioning people. And when they are not able to do that, or something has happened and they've, you know, slipped to not being able to function, that's a perfect indication that at least an assessment by a mental health professional is in order, or their doctor.
Yeah. And if a client is causing you anxiety,
right,
then they either need a more experienced coach or they need a therapist. You know, there are coaches that can handle not what Renee is talking about, but the client that causes you anxiety. Your sweet spot might be square two or square three coaching. So don't hesitate to send somebody on when you're in doubt. But don't wait to do these things, you know, sooner rather than later. Let's talk about other potential problem areas. Boundaries with clients. We want to maintain clean, clear, healthy boundaries. We don't ask our clients for help with our problems. We don't come to a session saying, oh, my God, what a weekend I had. You know, my kids are just such a pain. Or, I've got a splitting headache today. Oh, my God, you know, I wish it would go away. These are the kind of things that are going to erode client confidence in us. And remember, going back to the beginning of the call, how the client has entrusted you with a serious problem that they're willing to pay you and spend their time with you to resolve. So keep that in mind and make the session about the client, not about you. We also don't set up situations where there is a potential for trouble. Now, let's talk about transference. Transference is a technical term used in the psychotherapy area, but it happens with clients too in coaching relationships. And that's where a patient is basically projecting their feelings for a significant person onto you. It could be attraction to you. It could be sexual attraction to you. It could be rage or hatred or mistrust. It could be turning you into their mother, momification. It could be extreme dependency. Or it could be even putting you in like a godlike or a guru kind of status. It's common. It's normal. I had a client who called me Yoda once, and I simply reminded her that I'm human, and she's got the Yoda within her, and that's what we're in the process of finding out. It's her own inner Yoda. It feels really good when clients do that kind of transference, and when they get the rage, the anger, or the mistrust going at you, it doesn't feel nearly so good. But either one is detrimental to the coaching relationship. We're trying to help the client find the Yoda, the wisdom, the peace, the clarity within themselves. Now, when a client will hurl their rage at you, and it happens from time to time, it can be one of the most powerful things that happens in a coaching situation if you have worked through your own stuff. I had a client very recently fly into a huge rage and swore at me. Luckily, I had dealt with my own similar issues in this kind of situation, and I stopped talking about the issue we were talking about, and I just simply and calmly said to them, let's talk about that. How are you feeling in this moment? And the client was very embarrassed and did not want to do it, but I would not let this client wiggle out of it. And we spent the rest of the session dealing with the rage that surfaced when this client felt cornered. And what I want you to know is that broke open this client in a way that nothing previously had broken that client open. And this person was able to find their own heart after that and got very compassionate, and a sweetness emerged after that that I had not previously seen. But there was a time in my life when I was a newer coach, and a client flying in a rage like that would have been extremely upsetting to me, and it would have been all I could do to just kind of regain my composure and get to the end of the session. But if you can keep in mind that this is misplaced stuff, that they're directing something at you that they haven't worked through from an earlier, more significant relationship in their life, and help them work it through, you will be doing them a huge service. And if you can't, this is great coaching material for yourself. Get yourself coached and work through your fear or your upset at having stuff hurled at you, or having a client cry and go into meltdown, or whatever it is that provokes you during a client call. You will be a stronger, wiser, more effective coach if it comes up and if you deal with it. Any questions about that before I continue? And we are going to go over about, I'm going to guess, 15 minutes here, for which I profoundly apologize. Okay. Dual relationships, or what is also known as conflicts of interest. Coaching friends, coaching family. It's a dual relationship. You've got a friendship or a relationship, and you've got a coach-client relationship. It can get very tricky, especially when you're new to coaching. You're going to think this is the most brilliant stuff since sliced bread, and you want to share it with everybody. I was a horrible pest with my friends when I first discovered Martha Beck coaching. Please, please, please let me coach you. Let me coach you. Not recommended that you do it the way I did it. A much more reasoned approach, a much more professional approach is to just tell people, you know, I've encountered something that has brought huge joy and clarity and peace to me. I would love to share it with you. And if you could use some help with this part of your life or with what you're going through or in general, I'd be delighted to share it with you. And they either say yes or they say no, and we respect that. And when you coach them, draw a boundary around the coaching part of the relationship. Make an appointment. We'll talk at 4 o'clock on Tuesday about this. I'm going to be wearing my coaching hat. You'll wear your client hat. It's going to be, we're not going to chit-chat. I'm not going to talk about this. I'm going to extend to you the same confidentiality that I do with anybody else, and we'll treat it like a professional relationship. And that's the way to stay out of trouble. We don't stealth coach, or we don't coach people. Remember, that would violate informed consent. We keep it confidential. And let's say the client, you've coached somebody and they say, well, can I ask you something? Then you clarify with them afterwards, are you coming to me as a coach? Or are you coming to me right now as a friend? And you treat what they say accordingly. If you are in life coach training, what I recommend with my coach the coach students, because at first you need friends and family to practice with, don't say, I want to coach you. Say, I want to practice tools with you. And that way the expectation is very different. It's very clear. I'm going to, I learned this tool. Would you be willing to answer some questions so I can practice using it? And that way there's no expectation. But even with that, I would draw a boundary around it, treat it with some formality, and treat it with confidentiality. Even if you don't know coaching processes all the way through and how to do a complete session, for most people, just having somebody to talk to about the problem, being a witness for them, will help them tremendously. So it's a nice gesture to offer if you keep the goalposts where they belong and you're clear about the nature of the relationship. But remember, it's different because you've also got another relationship going on, and they need to save face with you, and you need to save face with them, and it's really hard to suspend that and let that go. So that's one kind of potentially problematic dual relationship. Business relationships are another. Coaching people with whom you have a business relationship there is very tricky. If you're going to do it, have a clear boundary around the coaching relationship and know which hat you're wearing. But ideally, you're going to refer your friends, your family, and your business associates to someone who can treat them at arm's length, because they'll be freer to reveal themselves fully and freely there. Going into business, well, let's say you've already got the coaching relationship established, you're going to compromise that if you do something like borrow money, lend money, date, go into business with, anything where you create another relationship, even take advantage of, you know, shopping in their boutique at a discount. You're going to be setting up a situation which is going to compromise your initial coaching relationship. And so I'm going to suggest that that's going to give you an agenda, and there you can avoid it. And I would say, don't do it. Don't go into business. Don't borrow or lend money or do anything that's going to compromise that relationship. Now, what about becoming friends with a client? Again, because it's a dual relationship then, at least wait till the coaching relationship is over. And what I want you to understand now that this is my eighth year as a Martha Beck coach, it's really hard for me to say when a coaching relationship ends, because I have a number of people in my practice right now who are coming back for the second or third time. And had I engaged in a close personal relationship with them, I would not be able to coach them like I can coach them now. So it's something you really want to think about ahead of time before you do that. If you are going to barter for coaching, you need to be very clear and precise about what your rates are, what the other rates of the client are for their website design services or whatever it is. You need to monitor it, keep it very clear, very clean, very precise. Now, there is one never, 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 never do this, and that is engaging in a sexual relationship or some kind of date relationship like that with a client. If you are having feelings for a client, terminate the coaching relationship right away if you are attracted to them in any way. That's called countertransference. You are transferring your feelings onto them. It can happen. If it does, terminate the relationship and seek advice from a mentor right away. that's going to irreversibly alter the relationship. And it's begging for a lawsuit. What about seeking testimonials from a former client? I would say to do that only well after the relationship is over. If you do it during a coaching relationship, you're putting pressure on the client. When you do it after a coaching relationship, make it optional. No pressure. If you found it helpful, I'd be most appreciative of a testimonial. And if they do it, fantastic. If they don't do it, fantastic. And they need to know that that's your attitude about it, so they don't feel pressured. If they happen to write you some amazing glowing letter or email spontaneously and you'd like to use it in your promotional materials, even there, I would suggest you wait until the coaching relationship is over. Asking an ongoing client, can I put this on my website, I think sends a message to a client that could interfere with the coaching relationship, because now they don't have the freedom to blow up at you in some corner of their mind like my client did that I told you blew up at me, and it was the thing that was necessary for their behavior to change. Any question about dual relationships or anything? Renee, let's start with you. Anything to add there?
I think one thing that came to mind for me was a key question that I ask myself, or if I'm mentoring people, when you get in the area of boundaries is, would you do this with every single client? Mm. And if the answer is, no, I'm doing this because X, Y, Z, now we're in the territory of looking into why this client, why are you making an exception?
Mm. That's a good point. Or how would I feel if this was in the newspaper tomorrow on the front page is another
exactly.
good question to ask yourself.
That's a great question.
Everybody knew that mm-hmm. I was doing this. How would I feel about it? Yeah.
Right. And you know, and if I would do it with every client, you know, then fine, like asking for testimonials. Let's say, like I do workshops frequently and I have a feedback form. And there's on every single feedback form, you know, may I use this as a testimonial, yes or no? Do you want your name or initials only? And that's for everybody. But if one of those people were a current client, like you said, I would not use it if they're currently ongoing with me.
Yeah.
Right. So it's both the nature and the timing of what you're doing.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay. Let's talk about terminating a client relationship. You know, you don't want to work with them anymore. You want to take a break from coaching, period, because you're going through something in your life, or you're going to go sail around the world for a year, or, you know, something is going on that you just don't want to continue with this client. Okay, let's say, you know, you won the lottery and you want to sail around the world for a year. That's pretty easy. You tell the client pretty straightforwardly, you know, I'm going to take a break here. But you do it in a way that's not abrupt. You let the client down gently. And that might not mean that on Tuesday you say, you know what, this is our last session, Renee. I'm out of here. I am on that boat Friday and I'm gone for a year. For some clients, that might be too abrupt. So keep that in mind. Typically, this comes up when the client is more problematic. They're not making progress, or you're just not getting a good feeling. What I recommend is that I make it about me, if I can. I don't think I'm the right coach for you. I don't think this is working, and I'm going to terminate our relationship. I've had a few clients that kind of hang on after it's, you know, they don't need me anymore. And with them, I'll say, you know what, I think it's time for you to leave the nest. And it's a sweet little metaphor there. You're able to fly on your own. You can terminate. You can taper if that's more appropriate. I've had some clients that I've said, you know what, we don't need to work every week here. I'm available to you if you need me. Or let's move out to once a month, and we'll do that for a couple of months and see how it goes. And I'm always here in the future if you need me. I think that that's the professional thing to do. And when we can make ourselves unnecessary in our clients' lives, we've really done our job there. So it's a feather in our cap. We don't do people any favors by letting them hang on to us indefinitely after the need for coaching has passed. So we want people to be very independent here. So that's something else to keep in mind. What about maintaining records? I think it's a good idea, at least to have a record of when you saw a client. The content is up to you. You do not need, there's no requirement that you keep detailed client notes or records. If you do, however, treat them with the same confidentiality that you treat everything else. Use a shredder when you get rid of them. Don't leave them laying around where other people can see them. We don't have a requirement to keep particular detailed notes or progress towards a goal or something like that. I keep pretty extensive notes, but if you looked at them, they would look like gibberish. It helps me keep focused. It's a way for me to keep my attention on what the client is saying. Other coaches can maintain that attention without doing it and keep no notes at all. Either way is fine. It's what works for you. I write down mostly limiting beliefs and the homework that I give people because that's what I want to remember and review for a follow-up session. So, let's talk about problems in general. Remember, use whatever forums are available to you. Renee and I are always here for you. You may have some other trusted mentor, but when in doubt, do get help. The other thing to do when in doubt is the same thing you would do in any other kind of situation. You get very still and quiet inside. Connect with your body. Connect with your inner wisdom. And you'll be able to find your way through whatever it is that you're going to have questions about. Most of the things we've been talking about today are never going to come up for you. Problems are rare, particularly if you're conscious and conscientious about your screening and your ongoing monitoring. So use that 30-minute initial consult wisely, pick and choose wisely. Keep your ongoing self-coaching practice going, and when you get in a pickle, get yourself coached by somebody outside yourself that can help. And I think you'll have a wonderful, prosperous, fantastic coaching relationship if you stay within these guidelines. And thank you guys so much for being here. We'll stay on for a few minutes if you've got any questions that you want addressed at this point. And if anybody, star sixes, Renee, anything else you want to add there to the end?
I don't think so. I was trying to remember, did you talk about referral fees?
I did not. Why don't you talk about referral fees?
Well, just my recollection is that there aren't, as you said, laws about this or, legal ramifications.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
Like for myself, I also have a licensed mental health professional qualification. So I don't ever do that because that's against that code of ethics. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that there's any regulation that covers this with coaching, but, you know, what is your recommendation?
Well, why don't we talk about what referral fees are?
Okay.
That is a coach with more business than they can handle will refer to person Coach A, and Coach A will give me back 30% of the fee in exchange for sending the client to them, right? That's what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There is no rule that says you can't do it. I think it's a very individual decision about whether to do it. Check your own body compass.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do it just because, you know, as a lawyer, it was a big no-no, and there were a lot of rules around it, and I've just been in the habit of giving away. If I can't handle somebody or they can't afford me or I think somebody else would be better for a particular situation, I simply make the referral, and I will tell the coach, I sent Madam X to you and, you know, help with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know there are coaches who refer for a fee, and we have coaches who pay referral fees. There is no rule against it. There's no requirement that you disclose it to the client. I'm going to say it's an individual kind of decision. Consult with your body compass, but know that there's a reason why therapists and lawyers aren't supposed to pay them. Doctors, I would assume, are not supposed to pay referral fees either, because basically
mm-hmm.
you're driving the client costs up. You know, you're working for
right.
$60 an hour and charging the client $100, and 40 of it goes back to the referring coach.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you want to add to that?
No, I appreciate that because there is no guidelines around it, and I think body compass and, you know, talk to a mentor if you're concerned about what the ramifications might be.
Yeah, but I mean, yep. there are coaches, and this is the way they start their practices.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if it feels okay to you, there's no rule against it.
Right. And I know coaches that have the referring coaches on their website, and so it's, you know, it's sort of public information
it might be public that they're referring, but is the nature of the referral fee on there in public?
Good question. I would have to look at that. I'm not sure.
That I haven't seen.
Yeah.
But again, you know, if everybody's body compass is cool with it, I think it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
great.
I'm trying to think how I would feel about it if I were a client and I found out that I'm paying $100 an hour to my client and she's sending $40 of that every $100 to that referral source. I might not be the happiest camper in the world about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what I would think through and make sure I'm comfortable with that. You know, that's that. Would I be comfortable if this was on the front page of the newspaper kind of situation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great question. And what I like that, where you put yourself in the other shoes and say, how would I feel about this? That's
yeah.
great.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, and it's why those things are typically not disclosed, because they know that people are going to realize it drives up their fee and they may not like it. But again,
mm-hmm.
you know, if everybody is okay with it, there is no rule per se against it. I'm glad you brought that up, though. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Just thinking of questions that have been asked. And
yeah. Yeah,
you know,
there's another question I got today that's really interesting. I got in an email about coaches who go through Martha Beck training and then call themselves leadership coaches or executive coaches. And I thought it was a pretty funny question coming to me. And when I wrote this coach back and I said, you know, I was a lawyer for 25 years, and I advised business executives and professionals about business strategy and whatnot for years and years and years. And from time to time, I coach those kind of people around leadership issues, around business issues, around strategy. Am I functioning like an executive coach? She said, well, yes, but I know you would never call yourself an executive coach, which is pretty funny because I have called myself an executive coach depending on the audience. But I don't call myself a certified executive coach. I never misstate my credentials. And if I had never had those experiences in business and with leadership, I wouldn't do it because I would think it would be stretching and overstating my credentials. But in that case, and I don't have it on my website, but when I'm hired to go in and do a corporate workshop, I call myself an executive coach because there, you know, it seems to fit and mm-hmm. it seems to work. So I don't have a problem with it.
It's a great question.
My body compass is cool with that.
Mm-hmm.
But if yours isn't, don't do it.
Right.
If you're annoyed by other people who do it, you may want to look at that. You know, do you
yeah.
have a personal issue that you need to work through about people who inflate their credentials? You know, what is that provoking in you, which is always a very cool thing. I love to get provoked, by the way. There was a time when I hated getting provoked. But these days I like it when I get provoked because it gives me more little corners to clean up, and then
mm-hmm.
I always wind up using it in my coaching somehow.
Right. Well, it's a great question. You know, I mean, the simple way to approach it is if that's the niche you want to be in and you're gaining experience, it'd be great to say enjoys executive coaching or leadership coaching.
Mm-hmm.
If your, you know, bio or your resume or your experience has quite a bit of that in your background, now it's backed up by your bio and your experience.
Right.
And, you know,
right.
but I agree with you about the certified part. That's misleading and, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Unless somebody's gone through a leadership coaching or executive coaching certification program or training program.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I just thought of one other thing, and that is we talked a little bit about documentation,
mm-hmm.
and we talked about, you know, clients who are a danger to themselves or you're worried they're going to harm themselves or others. Do you document any differently if it's been a client like that or you've made referrals or you've terminated? And would that be a time to just do a brief documentation just so you remember later what you did?
Oh, I would absolutely document that like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
I would in fact put that in my computer on my hard drive and make sure there was a copy in the cloud. That's the kind of documentation I would want to make sure I retained.
Right.
What happened and what I did, and I'm glad you brought that up. She's talking about the potentially suicidal client or where you're going to break confidentiality and report something. Absolutely document that very carefully.
Great.
Okay. Well, I think we're kind of there, huh?
I think so. Was everybody unmuted to ask questions?
Well, they can star 6 to unmute. Nobody
okay.
ever did. So,
okay.
But I see them out there, so thank you guys for being here today. And let's all go out and just have a blast doing this. It's so much fun, isn't it?
It is. Love it.
Okay. Bye, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Bye-bye.